We have Milwaukee Acting Police Chief Michael Brunson on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. He was sworn in just over a month ago after the city's fire and police commission demoted Alfonso Morales from chief back to captain. Morales retired days later. Brunson is a 25-year veteran of the department. He oversaw patrol operations as assistant chief. 2 years ago, as an inspector, he cited improving police legitimacy as the top challenge facing Milwaukee's police force. And recently, he's had to explain the department's use of tear gas and rubber bullets during protests of police brutality. What changes do you want to see to the Milwaukee Police Department? What do you want to ask the acting chief? It's 800-642-1234 to join the conversation. Chief Brunson, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yes, thank you. Glad to be here.
So with former Chief Morales' demotion and departure and your department's very public clashes with the police oversight agency and the continued protests of police brutality sweeping our nation, how do you approach your new job?
Well, I think one of the things that you have to do whenever you assume a new position is obviously be mindful of what's going on locally and, of course, nationally. And obviously, being a part of the agency for 25 years, I've seen that. I've seen the dynamics of today as it relates to our city and nationally. And obviously, these are challenging times right now as it relates to police-community relations. And so that dovetails into one of the biggest struggles that we have right now, and that's the violent crime problem that we've seen in our city this year. And so how do you address violent crime? You have to do it collectively with the community. And so if there is a rift, if there is a issue with the relationships between the police department, law enforcement, the Milwaukee Police Department more specifically, and the community, then that hinders that greatly. So that's one of the biggest challenges that we face as a city, as an agency. And so my job is to work as fervently as possible in order to repair those relationships, in order to make sure that we are collaborating as much as possible to address the violent crime issues that we see in our city.
You can't change history. You can't rewrite it. The history of police aggression in your department, the history of racial profiling, but you can make changes and crack down on behavior before another civilian is killed in your city tomorrow, next day. What are you doing now to change how your officers police the city?
Well, one of the things that we are doing as an agency and have done is increasing transparency, and that started many years ago, almost 5 years now, that we've had body-worn cameras. And that contributes to our ability to look at officers who may be having issues, officers who may be engaging in the type of behaviors that we don't want to see. And so we're able to address that now. In addition to that, you look at national campaigns, for example, the 8 Can't Wait campaign, which is a campaign that is nationwide, and it deals with use of force policies for police agencies. And if you take a look at the 8 Can't Wait tenets, then you'll see, and there was a story that was done on this comparing our standard operating procedures to the 8 Can't Wait points. And so if you looked at that, basically 6 of those at least were already part of policies that we had in place. And September 24th will be a meeting with our FPC, the Policies and Standards meeting, where we'll be looking at the other 2 points. So all 8 of those 8 Can't Wait points, if you look at it, our standard operating procedures will have the substance of those things. In addition to that, we do have the Collins Agreement, also known as the ACLU settlement. Within that, there are specific criteria and benchmarks that we have to reach as it relates to stops, as it relates to traffic stops, field interviews and the documentation of that. There's audits that are done. So there's some very stringent requirements, and we will have that for the next 3 years. It's been in effect for 2 years now already. So there's three more years that we will be a part of that agreement. We do have a consultant that does those audits and those reviews. So if you look at those changes that are occurring through our FPC already, through the Collins Agreement, through the body-worn cameras, which we've had for a number of years, our agency is changing.
We're talking with Michael Brunson, the acting police chief for the Milwaukee Police Department. You can join in. What changes do you want to see to the force and police departments across the state? What are your thoughts on policing in your community, policing in America? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Troy now in Muskego. Hi, Troy.
Hello. I just was asking, I'm going to ask a question. I don't know why the chief doesn't do like the chief in Green Bay did, which is actually march with the peaceful protesters and show in solidarity, especially after the Floyd murder. I don't think that's political at all. I think, you know, I own a security company. I have my security guards, especially because we deal with predominantly minorities, wear Black Lives Matter mask to show solidarity. I don't think Black Lives Matter is a political thing. And even if you don't go the direction of Black Lives Matter, at the very least, march with why people are protesting and show that you're part of those communities and you stand with them. That's all.
Chief Brunson.
Yes. Well, one of the things for me, and it's about dialogue. It's about talking. And I've made no secret that I would talk with, meet with protesters. I've done that numerous times because it's about the information exchange. It's about listening. And it's about seeing where we can come to agreements. I do not deny the fact that there have been controversial shootings across our nation, troublesome shootings across our nation that, of course, in the age of digital technology is everywhere, is ubiquitous. And so I'll be the first to say that I do see the point of many of the protesters, obviously, from what we've seen. And as law enforcement, we have to be honest about the issues that we see. And so that's why I am and our department is committed to changing, to looking at best practices, to making those necessary changes so that we can be a better agency. I just think that that goes with professionalism, that you have to do that as a professional agency. You have to listen to the community.
And the community wants officers to reach out and show their humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that we try to do that. We try to show our humanity. You know, a lot of times when we address protesters, sometimes in that particular moment, and I've seen this a number of times, it can be quite challenging because of the level of anger that we do confront. I've seen protesters scream racial epithets at officers for hours as they stand online. And so at that moment in time, it is a challenge to address someone, to be able to talk to them on a one-to-one level, to look at that humanity in that moment that is often charged.
We have Milwaukee's new acting chief of the Milwaukee Police Department, Michael Brunson, on the line. How is policing in your community? How have relations changed? Are they improving? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chief Brunson here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have the Milwaukee Police Department's new acting police chief, Michael Brunson, on the line. The Fire and Police Commission announced last week that a permanent chief will be selected by early December. The commission chair told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that the top five candidates will be interviewed publicly multiple times, the application deadline Friday. This change at the top is set against the backdrop of a summer of protests against police brutality, racism, the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha. Chief Brunson, do you see yourself as in an interim role here, or do you plan to apply to be permanent chief?
That's something that right now I'm not going to discuss. I'm committed to doing the best job that I can for this agency moving forward, but that's not something that I'll discuss right now.
Sure. Let's take a call. Rosa is joining us from Waterford. Hi, Rosa.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling. I noticed that most of these escalations occur because the person that was pulled over did not follow simple common sense protocol. When you get pulled over by a police officer, you're supposed to keep your hands on your wheels and don't move. When a police officer approaches the window, that's when he asks for your driver's license. Then you reach into your purse to grab your license. I learned that years ago. I don't know if there could be some kind of community outreach, maybe on the news, remind people, maybe during when kids take driving lessons. Maybe that's part of the curriculum.
Chief Brunson.
Yes. So we do have those informational sessions. A lot of times our captains will have crime and safety meetings each month at every district. We have 7 police districts here in the city. And so during those meetings, they'll talk about things like that. And we had a partnership with MPS many years ago in which some of our officers that work in schools would go and they would do informational sessions where they would talk about the type of things that the caller is referring to.
Back in June, the Common Council canceled bids for more tactical chemical equipment, namely tear gas. Your department asked city leaders to reconsider purchasing more tools for deploying chemical irritants. What is your stock of tear gas now? Are you restocking it and buying more?
That's not something that I'm going to discuss right now. During that period of time, that was when we were preparing for the DNC. And one of the things that we have to do as an agency is prepare for the worst. So obviously, we always hope for the best, but we would be derelict if we didn't prepare for the worst. We've seen how things that start as protests can sometimes in some places, and we've seen this obviously across our country, can get out of control. And so we have to be prepared to address it. And so that is why we did order.
Let me ask it this way then. What is your philosophy toward using tear gas and rubber bullets on the street against protesters?
Well, I've talked about this extensively. I've done a number of panels and hearings where I talked about the specifics. We have a SOP that spells out very, very specifically when we use chemical irritants. And so it was stated many times that we use chemical irritants on peaceful protesters. So that is totally against our policy. And anyone can do this, too. It's many of our SOPs, some things are
redacted, standard operating procedures.
Yes, standard operating procedures are right online, although there are some things that are redacted. However, as it relates to crowd control and the use of chemical irritants as it relates to crowds, it has to be declared an unlawful assembly. There's multiple warnings given saying that this is declared an unlawful assembly. You must leave this area or be potentially subject to arrest. And even after that, it involves an escalation by the crowd as far as throwing objects, bricks, bottles. When we saw all of those things, fireworks, there were multiple gunshots during the period of time that we had the unrest in our city. And so after all those measures are taken and we give multiple warnings, we give individuals an opportunity to disperse on every occasion before we do use chemical irritants. And we've had many of our personnel that were injured during that period of time to concussions, to one officer being shot, multiple bruising from bricks and bottles, et cetera. And so our officers don't join this department to be injured. We encourage people to protest peacefully. And we had many peaceful protests in our city. Most of the protests, by far, were peaceful. But there were situations in which individuals attempted to hurt officers, attempted to damage property. And so during those incidents, we declared it an unlawful assembly. We gave warnings using the long-range audio device, or LRAD. Multiple warnings were given. And then after the escalation continued with the throwing of objects at officers, then we did utilize chemical irritants.
Let me reintroduce you. Michael Brunson is acting police chief for the Milwaukee Police Department and taking your calls and questions. Let's bring in Ben now in West Salem. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I guess just listening to this conversation, I am not about defunding the police. However, I am about greater education for law enforcement. And I was listening to the lady's previous comments, and I'm from rural Wisconsin, and I would say the majority of the people around me believe in the same, what the lady said before. However, I would just state the officers are not, they're not always trained with the actual, they don't understand the law that they're trying to enforce. And I'm not saying quite often, I don't know how often, but it happens enough. And maybe rather than look into educating our youth to, which is important to listen to officers, you know, when they're giving them a lawful command, and I repeat that, lawful command, maybe we look first into more education, a longer education for law enforcement, so that they will better understand the laws correctly that they are trying to enforce, and that this might also help with the protests too. You know, if an officer better understands that this is a constitutional right and my emotions do not come into play, that might help kind of sedate some of this anger. And I would say maybe him forthright answering questions rather than responding.
Well, okay, Ben, I want to pause there. And Chief Brunson, where do you see a need for additional training in police tactics and maybe even specifically de-escalation tactics?
We train in de-escalation tactics. That's part of our use of force policy. It's part of everything that we practice. We believe in dialogue. We believe in obtaining voluntary compliance. That's what we are trying to do when we go to any scene. We try to gain voluntary compliance of the public. And so one of the things that I talked about earlier, our SOP 460 that deals with use of force, although the training was always part of use of force that we did at the academy, now it's going to be specifically listed in our new policy that will be changed on September 24th and discussed during the FPC meeting during that time. So it was always part of our training, but we're just specifically and explicitly listing that as a heading in our use of force policy.
You mentioned Fire and Police Commission, FPC, which is one of the oldest public oversight agencies, police oversight agencies in the country. How do you improve relations with the FPC?
I think it starts with communication and working collaboratively. Obviously, as you said, that they're one of the oldest in the country. They are our oversight body, and so my focus is to work with them as collaboratively as possible.
Is there anything further you would like to say there?
No, I mean, I think that just you start off with communication and you go from there. I mean, I think that the Fire and Police Commission and myself both want the same thing. They want a professional agency And obviously there may be, you know, different thoughts on how to get there, but that's where the conversation and communication comes in.
Chief Brunson, thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Michael Brunson is acting police chief for the Milwaukee Police Department. He's been acting chief since August. Coming up, it's the director of the Marquette University Law School poll on the new polling results and sentiment on how voters feel heading into the November presidential election. What sticks out to you in the new Marquette poll results? It's 800-642-1234. We'll be back after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. The latest Marquette Law School poll is in, and we're breaking down the numbers here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It surveyed 802 registered voters, conducted between August 30th and September 3rd. That is in the aftermath of the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha. New Marquette poll asked if people would take a COVID vaccine. Would you? How much do you pay attention to political polling less than 8 weeks from Election Day? We're at 800-642-1234. Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School poll, professor of law and public policy. He's co-founder of Pollster.com and the founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Starting with the presidential race, who came down on top this time when you asked voters who would they be choosing for president come November?
We're seeing a relatively tight race, but with Biden consistently ahead. This month, it's Biden 47, Trump 43, a four-point margin. And with 4 points picking Joe Jorgensen, the Libertarian candidate, this is the first time we've asked specifically about her, as she was just added to the ballot by the Elections Commission last month. But the trend on this is pretty steady. In May, it was a 4-point Biden lead, up to 6 in June, was 5 at the beginning of August, before events in Kenosha, and now is at 4 points today. So pretty steady. We're consistently in this sort of mid-single-digit number. Some other polling in the state has had bigger numbers, but I'd say if you look at those other polls, you'd also see that they haven't moved very much from their previous polls to their more recent ones.
What does this consistency tell you? You know, you've been doing polling a long time. What does this say?
Well, things are a little different this year than last, than 4 years ago. At this point in 2016, we were seeing somewhere in the 12 to 15% range of people saying they were undecided or would not vote for either Clinton or Trump. This year, that number's down to about 6 to 8%. So about half as many are expressing, you know, some degree of undecidedness at this point. The other thing that's very different is that in 2016, over 20%, 21% in our last poll, said they had an unfavorable view of both Clinton and Trump. This year, it's about 8% that are unfavorable to both. And so those two elements, fewer undecided voters, and especially less than half as many who dislike both presidential major party candidates, that suggests more stability. Now, this is 2020, so you never know what might happen today or tomorrow. And so there are real world events that could shake this up or things the candidates might do to shake things up. But right now, it looks like a bit more stable race than what we saw in 2016.
As you indicate there, polls are one moment in time at this, you know, one moment. Let's bring in a call. Steve in Sun Prairie is with us. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I was wondering if any part of the poll talked about enthusiasm. Compare 2016 to today, and I didn't see a lot of Trump signs. I didn't see a lot of people being extremely vocal about the support for Trump. This year, outside of Madison, completely different. I mean, up in Lake Wisconsin, they had a big boat rally that was up there, signs everywhere. It just seems a lot different, a lot more excitement about Trump than it was in 2016.
That's an interesting observation. We are seeing, first of all, Democrats and Republicans, Trump and Biden supporters, when we ask them, how enthusiastic are you about voting in November? We're seeing very small differences between the two. So we really don't see any enthusiasm gap by partisanship or by vote choice. Now, people said they were more enthusiastic, more certain they were going to vote last fall and through January and February. After February, enthusiasm dropped off among both parties and both candidates. It's hard to know whether that was because the presidential primaries were over and so people disengaged a bit, or whether it was the coming of the coronavirus that took people's attention away from politics. But we've seen that enthusiasm building back kind of slowly since March. So we're not quite as high today as we were, say, this time last year. But we are seeing an upward trend. But I think the biggest surprise or important point is that there's not much difference between either candidate. Some national polls ask the question differently. They ask, how enthusiastic are you about voting for Donald Trump? How enthusiastic about voting for Joe Biden? And there, Trump voters consistently look more enthusiastic, though some polls have flipped that and ask, how enthusiastic are you about voting against Donald Trump or against Joe Biden? And there you see that the anti-Trump vote is pretty enthusiastic against him, but maybe not as enthusiastic as voting for Joe Biden. So that's why you see different answers about enthusiasm. For me, the most important question is, will there be a turnout advantage for either candidate or either party? And at this point, we're not seeing a turnout advantage.
Yeah, and you talk about the virus, you talk about turnout, and you asked about how people go about the act of voting. When you asked respondents if they will vote in person or by absentee ballot, what did they say?
Here, there's an interesting trend. 43%, 32% say they'll vote absentee by mail. But half, 50%, say in person on election day. 14% say they'll vote early in person. But there's been a trend there. Absentee by mail in May was at 43%. So that's dropped 11 points since May. And in person on election day has climbed 11 points from 39 to 50. Most of that change has taken place among independents and Democrats who have become less likely to vote absentee by mail, though even there, among Democrats, 47% still say they'll vote early by absentee by mail. But there are some shifts taking place. I think the uncertainty of absentee voting and the uncertainties about the post office have shifted Democratic opinion a bit on this.
And you didn't, I would assume this question wasn't in 2016. We certainly weren't in a situation where we needed to vote by mail. Yeah, go ahead.
And in 2016, only about 6% of votes were cast absentee by mail, much smaller than in the spring election when it was about 60%. About 10 times the rate. Now, what we don't know is for this fall, how many absentee requests will there be? We're expecting a tremendous number, but will they be returned by mail or returned in person? Or will people change their minds between now and then and decide to vote either early in person or on election day?
Charles Franklin is here, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, professor of law and public policy. New poll is out. We're getting your questions, your insights. What are your thoughts on the economy? Is that an issue that drives you to vote? The Marquette poll has asked about COVID-19 vaccine. Would you get vaccinated? 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Diane now, joining us from Barron County this morning. Hi, Diane.
From Iron County?
Oh, Iron County. It says Barron here, but Iron. Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
And counties matter in voting, certainly. Diane, go ahead.
Well, I see Trump's signs, and I know a lot of people said that they would feel uncomfortable putting a Biden sign out because the Trump people are very intimidating. I bought a Biden T-shirt, and people are like, you're going to wear that? And I'm like, I don't know. I wouldn't put a sticker on my car because I would think that it might get damaged. So signs are not an indicator of enthusiasm.
Well, Diane, let me ask you this. Do you keep an eye on polling, on the national and Wisconsin poll that comes out here?
Yeah, but knowing what happened on the last election, I'm still nervous.
Well, Charles, you know, what can we glean from how people, you know, from yard signs or anything like that? Because that, too, is a way, I suppose, of surveying how people feel.
Well, I think that, you know, it's a visible display of opinion. And so you can certainly see that in a neighborhood, it's predominantly one side or maybe none of the other side. And so I think those are interesting things. I certainly enjoy driving through towns in the state. I'll often get off the interstate and just drive the country roads and go through smaller cities and towns. And you can bet that I pay attention to what signs and what ratio of signs there are. But I'll put on my pollster hat and say that the signs themselves are a display from involved people who are ready to make that declaration public, but it doesn't give you a good indication of what the people think who don't have yard signs out. And that's what we're trying to do with polling, is to give everybody's opinion an equal chance of being included in our poll so that we're representative in a way that yard signs and other public displays necessarily can't be representative.
We're breaking down the new Marquette University Law School poll with its director, Charles Franklin. Did anything surprise you about the latest Marquette poll results? Do you relate or disagree with how your fellow Wisconsinites answered the questions about politics? What are your thoughts on the economy? Is that an issue that drives you to vote? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Charles Franklin here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're breaking down the new Marquette University Law School poll just under 8 weeks to the November presidential election. We have the poll's director, Charles Franklin, as our guide to the poll that probes everything from views on the presidential candidates, attitudes conserving COVID, to views of protests over police brutality and the Black Lives Matter movement. Jeremy from Racine called in, couldn't stay with us, Charles, but wants to know if there was polling done on down to local politics. Jeremy says there's a lot of things happening in Wisconsin that people may not be aware of, and it would be interesting to see how Wisconsin residents stand on local issues. Can you help Jeremy out there with what you surveyed locally?
Right, and unfortunately, no, I can't really. We do a poll that's representative of the state statewide, but that means that within any single city or municipality, even the biggest ones, except for Milwaukee, we just simply don't have a large enough sample size to be able to represent the opinions there. One of the unfortunate facts about polling is that if you need to know something about opinion in a particular city, You really have to design a sample of that city specifically. And unfortunately, that's expensive, and not very many organizations have the wherewithal to do that kind of work.
Well, how did your survey respondents feel about the job Governor Evers is doing? What did they tell you?
There we see a real drop-off this month. In early August, he was at 57% approved, 37 disapproved, which had ticked up, actually, from the month before. But this month, he's fallen to 51% approval, 43 disapproval. That takes him back to where he was in January and February before the coronavirus epidemic hit. Once coronavirus hit, his approval soared. It was 65% in March, for example. And it's been working its way down. But this month, a six-point drop from early August is, I think, a kind of notable drop. His coronavirus approval also fell, but fell by 4 points, not as much as the overall job approval.
What did you find when you asked about how comfortable people were with schools reopening? What did you see there?
Here, an interesting pattern. In terms of the whole population, not very much change. 43% said they were comfortable reopening schools, 51% not comfortable. Not much change from a month ago when it was 45-48. But among parents of school-age children, there was a reversal. A month ago, 53% were comfortable, 45% not comfortable. But now that's flipped completely, 44% comfortable, 54% uncomfortable. So there has been movement of the people most affected by the school opening, those with school-age kids.
Yeah, so change in public opinion there within families. You also asked respondents if a vaccine for COVID-19 became available and it was free, would they take it? Explain what you're asking there about COVID.
Well, this is a complicated issue. You do have both concerns about the vaccine as well as concerns about the political process of approving the vaccine. So there's a lot of moving parts under this. We saw 35% saying they definitely get the vaccine and another 29% probably would get it, but 15% probably not and 19% definitely not. So about 2/3 would get the vaccine, probably, and about 1/3 wouldn't. But there was a substantial party split on this. 54% of Republicans would definitely or probably get it, but 76% of Democrats would. And on the wouldn't get it side, 43% of Republicans probably wouldn't or definitely wouldn't. And half that, 22% of Democrats probably or definitely wouldn't. And that reflects partisan differences in concern about the virus and how serious people think the virus threat is that differs between Democrats and Republicans.
Can you compare this to anything? Have you looked at this before?
No, we have not asked, unfortunately, about things like childhood vaccinations or other things. So I'm sorry to say I don't have a point of comparison for it.
Talking with Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, new survey of registered voters is out. Taking your questions on it at 800-642-1234. Matt from Wausau emailed us to say, why only 802 people surveyed? We have millions of Americans.
Yes, and the question is, if you want to know whether your soup is flavored right, do you drink the whole bowl to figure it out, or do you just take a spoonful?
I think you've been waiting
it?
to give that analogy, Charles. I can just feel it.
You feel like I kind of over-prepped for that answer?
I tell you,
but it's because of an entire career of answering, and Matt's question's perfectly reasonable. How do you represent a big population with a small group of people? But the soup analogy is really good. If you just pour your pepper and seasoning on the top and don't stir it and just take up soup off the top, you're going to get a biased sample. But if you season the soup and stir it and then taste it, That's almost exactly the analogy to the random sampling that we do that gives every phone number in the state, whether it's a landline or a cell number, an equal chance of being selected into our sample. And that's what makes a scientific poll something that's based on statistical probabilities rather than just taking the top right where the spice is.
Crystal clear, and I will never forget the soup. So thank you for that answer. I want to look very seriously here at Kenosha and Black Lives Matter. And between this poll and the last one you did in early to mid-August, there was the shooting by Kenosha police of Jacob Blake, followed by many nights of political unrest. What did you learn from this survey?
What we found was that there was almost no opinion change about the protests, about Black Lives Matter, or about the police before to after the Kenosha events. But there had been substantial change in opinion between June and early August pre-Kenosha. So in June, 61% approved of the protests. That fell to 48% in early August, and was at 47% now, post-Kenosha. With Black Lives Matter, 59% approved or had a favorable view in June, fell to 49% in early August, and is exactly the same, 49% now. Finally, the police are just a little different. 72% favorable in June, went up to 76% in August, but now has fallen 3 points to 73%. And we see big racial differences. African Americans and Hispanics became much more negative towards the police following Jacob Blake's shooting in Kenosha. And even among white respondents, there was a drop of 3 points in favorability to the police and a rise of 3 points in unfavorability following the shooting. So that's the one element where across the population we see large changes among people of color, smaller changes among whites, but movement in the same direction following the video of Jacob Blake's shooting.
How much more polling will you do before November 3rd?
We'll have two more out before the election.
So
54 days to go, I believe it is.
So you're staying busy, I would imagine.
Just a little bit.
So what kind of analysis will you do on polling numbers after the election? You know, is there a look back?
Well, what we do is mostly I sleep in December, to tell you the truth. But in the coming year, we'll more focus on state politics because we'll have a new budget being proposed in February. We'll have the legislature in session. And if President Trump wins re-election, we'll see the beginning of his second term and how that differs from now. And if Joe Biden wins the election, we'll have a new administration. So we'll turn our focus really to the future starting next year rather than trying to look backwards to this year's election.
Charles, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Always fun.
Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School poll. We have a link to the poll results at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, we check in with a pair of voting advocates about how they're helping people register amid the pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.